This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. When the two immigrant parents, in Zeno Sorder's latest illustrated book, go to the baker asking for a cake for their son, the baker asks for something different instead of money. 5 centimeters should do it, said the baker. Your height, of course. That starts the story of My Strange Shrinking Parents, a tale that connects to immigration, parental sacrifice, and the changing perspective that comes with growing up. Zeno Sorder is a writer and artist who lives in Melbourne, Australia, and is also the author of This Small Blue Dot. Today, Zeno and I talk about immigrant parents, the use of height as a symbol, and what's different about creating an illustrated book like My Strange Shrinking Parents. So, Zeno, thanks for coming on the show today. Maybe let's start with a basic question. What drove you to write My Strange Shrinking Parents in the first place?
Thanks, Nick, and thanks for having me on the program. I guess the starting point for the book was really I set out to make a fairy tale, but woven together with some of my own experiences growing up. I come from immigrant parents. My mom is from China and my dad is from England. And I was raised in quite a small country town in Australia called Bendigo, and I was actually born at home on a futon mattress. And the reason for that is that when my sister was born, my older sister, 2 years before me, she was born at a hospital. And when the doctors delivered her, they felt that her skin was a little bit yellow and potentially jaundiced. And so against my mother's wishes, who felt that she looked perfectly normal, they placed her in an incubator. And when my mother was physically able to, she jumped out of bed and kind of took my sister from the incubator and fled. And so growing up, I think me and my sister both felt a little bit out of place in this town that was very predominantly Anglo-Saxon. There weren't any other Asian families. And so I kind of made this book as the map that I needed as a young child who felt lost and out of place. And it touches on quite a few issues, namely immigration and growing up with immigrant parents. But I would say the heart of the book is about ideas of love and belonging and how, as we grow older, those ideas can also change so that things that we may be embarrassed or ashamed of when we're children can become things that we hold quite dear to ourselves and who we are as we become adults.
So the kind of core conceit of the book is that these parents, rather than paying for things like cakes or school uniforms with money, they pay for it with their height. So they give up their height over as their son is growing up. Why did you decide to use, I guess, height as the symbol for the act of parenting, as the thing that these parents are quote unquote paying, as they try to raise their son?
That idea actually came from a few places. I think growing up, I was always fascinated with how love is represented in particularly art and image making. And within children's picture book, it's quite uniform. It's usually shown through hugs and kisses and bright saturated colors and starlight. And that wasn't necessarily true to my own childhood. My mother had quite a traditional upbringing, quite an austere upbringing, and I remember going to primary school for the first time and seeing children saying goodbye to their parents and getting these, you know, big hugs and kisses on the cheek. And after a while, I had to pull on my mother's top and say, you know, Mum, you have to give me a hug and a kiss before I go into class every day. And she did that for many years, for a long time, because I'd requested her to do it, but it wasn't something that came naturally to her. But reflecting on my childhood, I never had any doubt that she loved me, or that she loved me any less. If anything, she loved me more than the other children, than the relationship they had with their parents. But when I was in university, I studied Mandarin, and there was a distinction that the Chinese teacher made that I'd never heard before. It's probably familiar to many of your listeners, but the distinction was that that Asian parents show love through food, whereas Western parents are comfortable showing their love through hugs and affection. And that immediately rang true to me. Namely because in pretty much everything my mother did, I could see the love that came through. And it wasn't just food or preparing the dishes that we like to eat the most. It was more so whether we were in a restaurant or at home. As soon as a meal was served, she would go through it with a, you know, chopsticks and pick out the best parts of each dish and put them in my sister's plate and my plate. And so when it came to this story and wanting to show a different type of love that wasn't necessarily the bright colors and the starlight, I thought that the sacrifice that our parents make, particularly immigrant parents, would be a good metaphor to show that. And it would allow me to explore a quieter type of love that I think is larger than the kind of the more showy and loud affectionate love that is more prevalent in children's storybooks.
So, you know, does it matter that the family in your book is an immigrant family? Is there something about immigrant parents that make them a good set of characters for this book, as opposed to a family in their own country, whether that's a country in Asia or the West or whatever?
That's an interesting question. I think that I guess to begin with, the story, I wrote the story because it's a story that connects deeply with me, and that's the emotional journey that I'm familiar with. But beside that, I think that there is something about immigrant stories where there is a level of sacrifice and resilience and tenacity just naturally built into those stories. And aside from that, the thing that interested me is there's an intergenerational story to be told as well, where the parents and the child aren't necessarily involved in the same realities to the same degree. And growing up, when we left Bendigo when I was a teenager, and we moved to a larger city called Melbourne, and we moved to an area outside what are known as the Public Housing Commission flats, which is essentially subsidized housing. And for the first time, when we moved to that area, I met children who had names that were just as strange and as foreign as my name. And I was able to spend time with a lot of immigrant kids from many, many different backgrounds, and they're still some of my best friends today. But spending time with them and their families, one of the things that struck me was regardless of how different we were culturally or the values that our parents were imparting to us, there was a very strong commonality in the way that our families functioned, the priorities that our families had. And that immigrant story kind of forms the basis of this story. And I was conscious when I was making it of to not make it too specific to my own circumstances, but try to broaden it so that other people from different cultures would be able to read themselves into it as well.
Thought about with shrinking parents' idea, it seems also gets to like the idea of growing up. You know, as you grow in size and in age, your parents do seem smaller. The image of the shrinking parents to me also kind of felt like a metaphor for kind of growing up.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. There's one of the things that fascinates me is kind of this a type of symmetry to a human life, and I think this is talked about a lot. I know my father talks about it a lot in Asian culture, with the idea that we're taken care of by our parents when we're young, with the with the hope, I guess, that when our parents become older, that we will be there to similarly take care of them. And there's a poem that I love by an American poet called Tony Hoagland. And I can't remember, I believe the name of the poem is called Lucky. And it's a very emotionally complex poem, but at its center is this relationship that he has with his elderly mother, and of him having to bathe and feed her in her older years, and what he's feeling in that he's effectively repaying the debt that he owes her for raising him so well. And so with this story, which is largely about cycles and cycles of love and the reciprocal nature of love, I wanted to embed that message in the story. And I've tried to do it in a few different ways. And one of the benefits of having an illustrated story is that one of the ways I was able to do it was by mirroring the composition of the artwork, so that not many people pick up on this. But I'm hoping that there is perhaps some kind of, deeper awareness of it at a subconscious level, that at the beginning of the story, there are pages of the parents taking care of the child. And then at the end of the book, those compositions are effectively mirrored to show that the child now taking care of the parents.
Well, I mean, let's get into that a little bit. I mean, there's this idea, and whether or not it's how much it's really based in fact, but there's this idea that family culture in Asia, in East Asia, is much more focused on intergenerational support. Parents investing in their children, sacrificing for their children. The grandparents taking care of their children's children, so the grandparents stay home while the parents work. Then children taking care of older generations in their old age. And I'm sure there's a big debate about how Asian that really is, how true it really is, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess in kind of thinking about your book, how much did you want to, I guess, refer to that idea of that kind of intergenerational support?
I grew up in a at many times our grandparents would come and live with us, so we had a three generational household, and I absolutely loved it. And so that type of family dynamic, I think, in my mind, it is very Asian. When I finished university, I've had quite a varied career before I got into picture books. And one of the careers I had was I worked as a consul officer for the Australian Consulate General in Shanghai. And at that time, I opted to live in a more local apartment building. And we were surrounded by the type of dynamic that you were talking about, with the grandparents taking care of the younger children. And so to my mind, it is quite an Asian dynamic, and it is still something that is quite prevalent today. My own experience of that dynamic was that it actually gave me a snapshot of the entirety of a human life. I think for a lot of children nowadays, they're quite removed from those later years. And there's obviously an incredible amount to learn from somebody who is experiencing kind of the latter part of their life, and what their concerns are and what they're thinking about. But aside from that, I think the thing that I took most from it was my grandmother thought, my Chinese grandmother, she thought on a different scale of time than my parents did, and than what I think most young people do. And that is that she was a very enthusiastic gardener. And I remember her planting apricot trees, and this is when she was already past, 80 years of age. And she would plant these trees, and she would often say to us, you know, I'm planting these trees, not so that I can benefit from the fruit, but that, you know, you will be able to see these plants fruit, and your children, and hopefully your grandchildren will. And that was, you know, a different take on life than what I had seen previously.
So we were talking before this interview, and you mentioned that you were at the Hong Kong International Literary Festival. And you mentioned that there was a lot of interest in talking about how the how books like yours, how books like By Shrinking Parents, are a way to kind of help children understand these sorts of questions and these sorts of issues. I wonder if I might get into that a little bit, and kind of how, like, I guess how literature, how illustrated books can help kind of grapple with these kind of tough questions that maybe children don't have the vocabulary to talk about at the age they're at.
Yeah, it was really fascinating being at the literary festival. One of the subjects that came up, which I think a lot of people who love books are talking about at the moment, is this idea of bibliotherapy. And that it's, I guess, an expanding field that's supplementary to the work that a lot of counselors are doing. And the idea is that if somebody is facing a particular problem or a particular issue in their life, then they will be prescribed a reading list of authors and books that kind of tackle this issue head on. And the idea is that it's reading that kind of work removes the person from their direct issue and allows them to view it from a different perspective, a more removed perspective, which can not only be cathartic, but can also help them understand the different dimensions of the problem and a better way to tackle it. And this hasn't really been spoken a lot with children's literature, but I have noticed with children's books, a lot of them are very issues-based, and therefore, for example, anxiety, grief, ADHD. And the way that I know a lot of parents use books, and a way that a lot of bookshop sellers will kind of recommend books to parents, is that they provide them as a starting point. So say, for example, a loved one has recently passed. A parent will read a book about grief, and then having the book having broached the subject and kind of opened up that emotional territory, the child will then feel a little bit more comfortable talking about it and sharing their inner world and their feelings with their parent or guardian. And so I think that, you know, it's hugely beneficial to not only adults, but children as well. And I have noticed that with children's book, there's a lot more diversity in the issues that they're tackling, which is fantastic to see. And with this book as well, what I'm hoping to address is children who feel out of place or a little bit strange, as I did with a child. And I hope that it reaches other children who may be in a similar position. And hopefully it will make them feel a little bit less lonely by reading that book.
Yeah, and this gets at something else that's in your book that I just remembered, is the sense that the child, the son, feels guilty about the parent sacrificing so much. And of course, that's also because the child is himself bullied from from his peers and classmates about what his parents are doing. And so I wondered, maybe just kind of a last question on the story of the book itself. How did you see kind of guilt, and I think undeserved guilt, playing into this conversation?
I think that it's an interesting question. One of the benefits of the book is that it takes place over a large span of time, and so we're able to see how the child's feelings develop. And I know that as a child, and now having children of my own, that desire to fit in, to be just like everybody else, is so crushingly overwhelming when you're young. And that was one of the things that I was trying to get at and broach that subject. And as a young child, I did feel that the only thing I wanted to be normal, that I didn't want to have the strange name. I didn't want to have the mixed background. For the longest time, I tried to convince my family members to call me Kyle instead of Zeno, but unfortunately, it never stuck. And what happens is, as you get older and you define yourself more in relation to other people you meet and what you think is valuable, often you will, you know, take those things that you were embarrassed by and find new meaning in them. And that certainly happened for me. And that happens for the character in this book, but with a lot of my friends as well, who came from, you know, Sri Lankan, Lebanese, Costa Rican, Turkish, Greek backgrounds from all over the world. Growing up in Australia, they all felt that instinct when they were young to just want to fit in, to just want to eat Vegemite sandwiches like all the other children, you know, to be terrified having to open up their lunchbox at lunchtime, worried about what their mum had packed them that day. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting subject, and I hope I've kind of done it some justice. I've really only touched on it briefly in the story, but I think it could be a much longer story that a lot of children will be able to relate to.
Well, I think the last question I want to ask on the book, and, you know, I think unlike a lot of books we do on the show, your book is an illustrated book. It has these great pieces of artwork throughout My Strange Shrinking Parents. And I guess to end, I want to just ask about the process of writing an illustrated book like yours, and how that maybe differs from what people might think the process of writing a book purely in prose would be.
Yeah, during the literary festival, I was on a panel with some other children's book writers and illustrators, and one of the subjects that came up was about the illustration of children's books, and the writer who was present, who was a lovely man, he mentioned that he actually felt a little bit sorry for illustrators because the concentration is really on the text, and the text drives the story forward, whereas the illustrations are really glanced over, they're not lived with for an extended period of time. And I said that I actually felt that the writers had the harder job, because with text it has to pass through the conscious mind, which can be a lot more critical. Whereas with illustration, a lot of what you do can touch on the reader's emotions in a much more visceral and immediate way. And an example, I think when you watch a movie, music can play kind of a similar role, in that you don't always notice it's there, but it is guiding your emotions throughout, you know, the whole experience. And with illustration, I guess just as a quick example, with the illustrations, I tried to introduce a lot in the backgrounds and a lot of metaphor and a lot of symbols that I don't necessarily expect the reader to pick up on, but I'm hoping that it is reaching them, I guess, like I said earlier, at a slightly deeper subconscious level. And an example of that is with the parents who are farmers in this story. They're always drawn in natural environments. And if they're not in a natural environment, if, for example, they're at the principal's office in school, that office is drawn with green hues to show that it's a comfortable place for them. And then midway through the book, there's a break where I want the reader to think that perhaps things aren't as comfortable as we thought they were. And to show that in an illustrative sense, I kind of removed all the nature and all the green and had them on a stark grey street side with these large figures looming over them, and it's quite a monochromatic drawing. And so even though the text may not be saying something has clearly changed here and the book is kind of shifting gears, I am able to do that through the illustration and the way that the characters are portrayed and the way that the world is portrayed.
Well, I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Zeno Sorter, author and illustrator of My Strange Shrinking Parents. Zeno, I do actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What might the next project be?
My first answer, where can people find my work? I think within Asia, I know within Hong Kong, my books are available through Bookazine and some other bookstores, M Plus in Hong Kong as well. And online, I think through Amazon and other online retailers, they are available too. In terms of what's next, I'm kind of dabbling in a huge range of things. There's the possibility of My Strange Shrinking Parents being turned into a short animation film, which we're currently exploring. And I've been a little bit slack, but I have started work on another picture book. And I'm hoping that that will be wrapped up in potentially a year or two. I work extremely slowly, so it does take me a while, but I'm hoping it'll be on bookshelves in 1 or 2 years.
I look forward to hearing more about it. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's N-I-C-K-R-I-G-O-R-D-O-N. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. This podcast, the ARB Podcast, is on all of your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for info who's coming up on the show. But before then, Zeno, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.